Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Blitzkrieg broadcast. This is Kyle Hunt. Thank you so much for joining me here at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. It is August 2nd, 2013. Just so you know, we have been having some issues with RenegadeBroadcasting.com and the social network AlternativeSocial.com, so I'm very sorry if you haven't been able to get on the website. I think there are big things going on right now, and we've been hitting some key points here on this network, so perhaps that has something to do with it, or it's just you know, it's just a coincidence, but it's an ongoing type of operation to make it so that we don't have an easy time getting our information out to you guys. Last night, Mike had a great show, but we had to stream it over the website network because he couldn't even get into Blog Talk Radio to properly do his show. But it is uploaded there now, and it's uploaded over at the site if that site is available to you. But please do check out everybody on the network because there are lots of important things being said here. I am usually on Mondays doing a special show here, filling in on Friday. Lou is on Tuesdays. Dana is on Wednesdays. Mike is on Thursdays. Siegfried is usually on Fridays. The Roundtable is on Saturdays, and David in Texas is on Sundays. I hope you all can hear me out there. Please confirm for me in the chat that I'm coming through all right, and I'll move on with the topic for today. Today's topic is pretty much a continuation of what I was discussing on my last show, which is the hidden history of white slaves. Really, really important topic. Please do check out that show. This is one of those things that can really destroy the anti-white system that has been set up against us. Because once people understand these facts, and the whole game, all of the white guilt, all of the crap that's been fed to us over the years about how evil whitey is, start to completely disappear. And with today's show, I'm going to be focusing in on who really has been behind the enslavement of us all. And you guys should know by now that, well, it's the Jews. Just think about it from a very basic level. What do they call us? Goyim, right? Goyim. Goyim meaning cattle. And cattle relating directly to chattel, as in chattel slavery. We are the cattle slaving and dying for them. And it's not every single Jew that is enslaving us, not the Jew down the street that is causing us to be in bondage. They don't really speak out against the system, but how many of our people speak out against the system? Not enough. So we are in a system of chattel slavery, and we pay so much money for everybody else, especially for Israel, for the Jewish banks, and then those out there that think that they have been enslaved forever by the white man. We pay for them to have large, large families. This is a form of reparations, is it not? Oh, we got to help out the minorities. And even people who were never enslaved in this country are benefiting from this anti-white, white guilt system. So I say it's about time we broke out of the pens, broke out of this little prison they've set up for us, this little slave factory, and we start to reclaim our destiny. But I'll get to that a little bit later. Let's look further in to this institution of Jewish slavery. The Oxford Dictionary of the Jewish Religion, published in 1997 out of New York, points out the institution of slavery whereby a person forfeits individual liberty and becomes bonded to an owner is accepted by the Bible and the Talmud as a normal feature of the economic and social system. Both the Bible and the Talmud endeavored, however, to ensure humane and considerate treatment of slaves. Just like the humane and considerate treatment of the cattle in our world today, right? They would never abuse those cows, would they? Or any of the other animals that are tortured, slaughtered in our current system in the most disgusting of fashions, sometimes called kosher or halal. Oh, thanks, Semites. Your practices are so great. This is out of the Talmud, Menachot 43b through 44a. It was taught, our Judah used to say, a man is bound to say the following three blessings daily. Blessed art thou, who has not made me a heathen, who has not made me a woman, and who has not made me a brutish man. Our Ahab Jacob once overheard his son saying, blessed art thou, who has not made me a brutish man. Whereupon he said to him, and this too, said the other. Then what blessing should I say instead? He replied, who hast not made me a slave, and is not the same as a woman? A slave is more contemptible. So what's going on there is that what's being interpreted is that a brutish man is actually meaning slave. So what we just heard was a prayer or benediction to be said by a Jewish man every day, thanking God for not making the person a Gentile, a woman, or a slave. Blessed art thou, who is not a heathen or a Gentile, a woman, or a slave. Do you see what kind of system they have going here? These people who are claiming to be feminists, all these Jews in the feminist profession. Jews hate women. That's why the Orthodox ones will cause them or make them shave their heads after they get married. This goes on. They hate women. They're just vessels to create more Jews, the masters of this earth. Thank God for not making me a Gentile, a woman, or a slave. And a slave's a little bit worse than a woman, so that passage says. But we don't hear a lot about this Talmud. Do you know why? Well, because if we knew, we'd actually do something about it and point the finger at who has been enslaving us. Out of this is from Libre David 37. To communicate anything to a goy about our religious relations would be equal to the killing of all Jews. For if the goyim knew what we teach about them, they would kill us openly. What do they teach? What do these Jews teach? Well, here's from Simeon Hadarson, 56D. When the Messiah comes, every Jew will have 2,800 slaves. From Mas Shabbat, 31B, Resh Lakish said, he who is observant of fringes will be privileged to be served by 2,800 slaves. For it is said, thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations, shall even take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, etc. So these learned Jews will just be having people begging to be their slaves. What is going on today with these the job shortages and these exploitative corporations? People are just begging our Jewish masters, oh, please, can I have a job? Please, please pay me $10 an hour. Please, please. And then the illegal Mexicans, who we are often made to loathe because their presence here is loathsome to us and we have to pay for them, well, they are actually being paid less. They get less than the minimum wage. So they really are trying to stir up conflict between the lower rungs of their slave system and cause us to fight and kill each other. And in doing so, we will only be propping up their system. And Dana is saying that from Isaiah, the quote is, the Gentiles will wipe dust off the soles of their feet. But this is obviously not just from the Talmud, which is a little bit more explicit about their goals for enslaving all of the goyim, all of the Gentile. You look at the Bible, and in the Bible, slavery is endorsed. Slaves are told to be good to their masters. I've gone through the atrocities of the Bible on a previous show, but I'm just going to read through a few more quotes here so you understand what this Bible is really all about. From Leviticus 25:44, your male and female slaves are to come from the nations around you. From them you may buy slaves. Everybody else around you, purchase them as slaves. That's good. Romans 13:1-5. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. Wow, this Bible's great. Here's Titus 3:1. Remind the people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever is good. Titus 2:9. Teach slaves to be subject to their masters in everything, to try to please them, not to talk back to them. 1 Peter 2:18. Slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. It doesn't matter if your slave master is harsh. Be good to him anyway. Just turn the other cheek. Really, it's godliness. This is from, I think, Corinthians. I might have copied it down incorrectly. 3:22. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it, not only when their eye is on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. So even if your master isn't watching, do good for him. Work your hardest, slave. The gulags are for your own good, goyim. Here's from 1 Corinthians 7:21-22. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. Similarly, he who was a free man when he was called is Christ's slave. Ephesians 6:5. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Actually, there's a caller on the board here, and so it's a little early. I don't usually take calls this early, but they've been waiting, so I'll take this one. Caller, you're on the air. Hello, this is Pastor Rabbi Eli James. I'm a Christian identist, and I take a lot of offense at what you've been saying. It sounds pretty satanic and rebellious. Praise Yeshua. Hail Yahweh. It's really against the Lord what you are saying here. Because, well, you have to understand, we're the real Jews. The white man, we're the real Jews. And so you have to see, you have to read, interpret into the Bible when they're saying that you got to be good to your Jewish master. They're talking about us. Oh, well, yes, Pastor Rabbi Eli James, you do look like a big Jew, like a Sephardic rabbi. So it does seem that this does fit in what you're saying, but I really refuse to accept your interpretations of the Aryan man being the real Jews. This whole thing is despicable. Well, I think you should just keep your mouth shut, because I know the Bible and you don't. And so, you know, it's really a matter of knowing your place in this world. And we really don't like what you're doing over here. I consulted with Rabbi Fink, and we're going to try to get you guys shut down, because it's satanic, it's hateful against Christians, and as I said, you all just need to shut your mouths. It's like our women. We just need them to shut their mouths, get in the kitchen, because, you know, they are meant for feeding you and breeding with you, and that's about it. So, Yeshua is coming, okay? Yeshua is coming, and I'm really excited about it. I love when Yeshua comes, and I look forward to it. And when he does, us, the real Jews, will, we'll be having lots of good times, because we'll have, you know, 2,800 people working for us. So, a lot to look forward to. Just big shout out to North Powell over at Cockroach Alley, doing a great job over there. All right, Pastor Rabbi Eli James, thanks for the call. I'm gonna be moving on though, because, well, I've got a little bit more to get through here. Christian Idenis, very interesting breed, that's for sure. All right, a lot of people have heard this quote before, but I'd like to let people know about it again. And this is coming out of actually Jewish press, and this is out of Jerusalem. Israeli Sephardic leader Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, in his weekly Saturday night sermon, said that non-Jews exist to serve Jews. Goyim were born only to serve Jews. Without that, they have no place in the world, only to serve the people of Israel, he said during a public discussion of what kind of work non-Jews are allowed to perform on Shabbat. Why are Gentiles needed? They will work. They will plow. They will reap. We will sit like an effendi and eat, he said to some laughter. Yosef, the spiritual leader of the Shas party and the former chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel, also said that the lives of non-Jews are protected in order to prevent financial loss to Jews. With Gentiles, it will be like any person. They need to die, but God will give them longevity. Why? Imagine that one's donkey would die. They'd lose their money. This is his servant. That's why he gets a long life, to work well for this Jew, said the rabbi, who recently turned 90. So those are the kind of thoughts coming out of leading Jews in Israel. Very, very interesting, is it not?
And by God, and in the affairs of mankind, God is not a stranger to the children of Abraham. Israel, hear the words of my mouth. He promised that Israel would rise again. For 2,000 years, you stood watch. You held on to this promise. And we have seen this promise fulfilled. Israel, we have witnessed the dawn of your redemption. We live in an age of man-made technological miracles. But these are the divine days of divine miracles. Not by any hand of God, of man. Not of any hand of man. Whether his name be Balfour or Truman, does Israel exist? Israel is here because the God of Abraham keeps his covenant. In Israel, there is more courage in one small square mile than in all of Europe. In Israel, there is more courage in one soldier than in the combined and cold hearts of every bureaucrat at the United Nations.
So, Saturday, I was following the news of the shooting in Norway and the explosion in Norway, which happened, what, on Friday?
Yeah, the explosion was, and then we left the air, and
right.
And then he went to, the camp.
Yeah, well, when we heard the explosion, everybody was willing to say, it's Muslim extremists! It's Muslim extremists! I don't think we made a comment on it because we didn't know, other than there was a bombing that happened. And as the thing started to unfold, and then there was a shooting at a political camp, which sounds a little like, you know, the Hitler Youth or whatever. I mean, who does a camp for kids that's all about politics? Disturbing. But anyways,
name the country in the Middle East that has the values, generally speaking, that we have. I can only name one. Why are we standing with all those who are against Israel?
All right, and that was my Glenn Beck mashup. First, you heard him speaking in Israel, saying how in one square mile of Israel, there is more courage than all of Europe combined. Wow. Then you heard him talking about the Utøya slaughtering by Anders Breivik, of who he called Hitler Youth, because, well, they were boycotting Israel. And funny enough, or disgusting enough, Glenn Beck said there that it was rather disturbing that children were involved in anything political, even though he has his own 9/12 Foundation, you know, the day after September 11th, which organizes summer events for children, and it's all politically based. It's not okay for Goyim to organize politically against Jews, only with Jews, under Jews. So you also heard him railing against the UN, as if the UN wasn't really the Jew-N. But Israel does often have some manufactured conflict with the United Nations, because the United Nations holds many other countries accountable in ways that it does not hold Israel accountable. Here's just one example of Israel and the United Nations' stormy relationship together, their love affair, let's say. In November 1975, the United Nations General Assembly, Resolution 3379, declared that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. In December 1991, after that New World Order of Bush was announced, the General Assembly rescinded this resolution through Resolution 4686. at the time, the Soviet Union, a major sponsor of the Zionism is racism doctrine, had completed its rapid collapse. Israel made revocation of Resolution 3379 a condition of its participation in the Madrid Peace Conference. Goyim, do what we say, or else we'll bomb you all. Have you not heard of the Samson option? It sounds a little bit more like a Russian Jew I'm doing there, perhaps. We really do have a caller waiting here this time, so I'll go to this. Hello, caller, you're on the air? What's your name? Where are you calling?
How are you doing, sir?
Excuse
sir, can you
me,
hear
can you
me?
Say that again? Yes.
Yes, how are you doing, sir? Can you hear me?
Said yes. Get
oh,
off
okay.
the line. Get off the line. No time for it. I have no time for that crap. Sir, can you hear me? Sir? Get the hell out of here. Oh, you don't think I'm a pro? I've been doing this for a while. Some people listening out there might be thinking that I'm just being a little harsh on the callers. You have to have a good Judar, which is pretty much the same as a troll radar. The controllers, they hide under the bridges, take their tolls. They didn't build those bridges, did they? No. But they exercise the right to toll all of us. It's like trawling, you know, when you're fishing, they're trolling. And just raking in all of this money from the stupid goyim. We are in a large penitentiary. We have been penned into this pen through the pen of the Jew. They've just written it down. That's been their magic. A lot of it is just through their knowledge of legal systems and religious mind control. And this includes the television as well. If you don't think that's religious mind control, then you're absolutely wrong. And their movies. Remember, penned in by the pen, right, in the penitentiary. Think about this one. From Indiana Jones, I think this is the Last Crusade, there's that line, the penitent man may pass. So Indiana has to get down on his knees to avoid some booby trap that would have cut his head off. The penitent man may pass. Do your penance. Penitent, let's look it up. Adjective, feeling or expressing sorrow for sin or wrongdoing and disposed to atonement and amendment. Repentant, contrite. Only the penitent man may pass. They don't follow the same kind of morality that they have imposed on us, the slave morality. They follow their own form of morality, which is whatever is good for them and destructive to us is the greatest good. And of course, in that that movie, and all Indiana Jones movies, right, it's the evil Nazis who are the villain. Wait, I mean all movies pretty much ever, even if it's not explicit, have the Nazis as the ultimate villain. And I'm going to actually play a song here because my cat's outside and I've got to let him in. Otherwise, he's going to sit there and meow for a while.
Bomber über Dresden, die kamen in der Nacht. Bomber über Dresden, den Tod im Bombenschacht. Bomber über Dresden. Sie brachten euch den Tod. Bomber über Dresden. Sie brachten euch Elend und Not.
That was the band Sleipnir, or Sleipnir, with Bomber Over Dresden. And that obviously means Bomber Over Dresden. And I'm sure you know what that reference is. The burning of many women, children, and elderly, and non-combatants in a very short period of time by Allied firebombing, and then strafing of any survivors. It was absolutely disgusting, but yet we're always told about the Nazi atrocities, which can't even be proved. Most people have no idea what Dresden even represents. They don't know what it was before it was destroyed. Beautiful, held amazing artwork. The architecture was incredible. But the Jews destroy anything that they see as beautiful in us or by us. Let me tell you about the villains. This article is titled Jews and Slavery Throughout History. I found it from wakeupfromyourslumber.com. It would not be an unfair assumption to say that the majority of Americans think of slavery as an institution peculiar to the antebellum South, and if not thought of as exclusive to the South, at least practiced there in a manner uniquely unjust in world history. This underlying theme of slavery as a peculiarly white European habit has been implied by Hollywood and the American media in general. And the media, as has been noted elsewhere, is majority Jewish-owned and controlled. But that assumption is not historically accurate. Slavery has never been exclusively an European institution. It has never been historically, and it wasn't even in colonial America, writes historian Peter Weinerk. As almost all the early Jewish settlers in America belonged to the wealthy classes, it was natural for them to accept the institution of slavery as they found it, and to derive as much benefit from it as other wealthy men. And furthermore, according to Priscilla Fishman from Jews of the United States, 1973, Jewish entrepreneurs were engaged in the slave trade on the North American mainland, participating in the famous triangular trade. And Dr. Marcus, in his study, United States Jewry, 1776 to 1985, tells us the following. All through the 18th century into the early 19th, Jews in the North were to own black servants. In the South, the few plantations owned by Jews were tilled with slave labor. In 1820, over 75% of all Jewish households in Charleston, Richmond, and Savannah owned slaves. In 1820, let me read that again. Over 75% of all Jewish households in Charleston, Richmond, and Savannah owned slaves, employed as domestic servants. Almost 40% of all Jewish households in the United States owned one slave or more. There were no protests against slavery as such by Jews in the South, where they were always outnumbered at least 100-1. But very few Jews anywhere in the United States protested against chattel slavery on moral grounds. The reason for the silence was most likely the heavy Jewish involvement in the slave trade. Jews were engaged in money lending, brokering, and banking from the earliest colonial age. Lee Friedman, in his book Pilgrims in a New Land, out of Philadelphia in 1948, informs his readers that the history of Israel in the United States is no ghetto history, walled off from the history of the land. And slave trading was financed through the New York banking firms. And another Jewish writer, Max J. Kohler, in Phases of Jewish Life in New York Before 1800, and that was published in 1960, tells his readers that it is of considerable interest in this connection to note that Jews were among the founders of the New York Stock Exchange in 1792. Stanley Feldstein, again a Jewish writer, states in The Land That I Show You, Three Centuries of Jewish Life in America, from 1978, states, American Jewish merchants, using their religio-commercial connections, enjoyed a competitive advantage over many non-Jews engaged in the same lucrative intercolonial trade. Since the West Indian trade was a necessity to America's economy, and since this trade was, in varying degrees, controlled by Jewish mercantile houses, American Jewry was influential in the commercial destiny of Britain's overseas empire. The very fact that Jews had also played a central role in bringing slavery to the West Indies and established numerous trading posts there helped them to establish the trade in North America. These locations include Curaçao, Suriname, St. Thomas, Barbados, Madeira, and Jamaica. Again, I quote, and hence Jewish traders in New York had a marked advantage over others in this West India trade. Historian Peter Weinick flatly stated that this trade was principally in the hands of the Jews. The predictable Jewish response to these revelations is that only a few Jews engaged in slave trading, or that their participation was minimal, but according to the following, such is not the case. This is from Liebman. They came with ships carrying African blacks to be sold as slaves. The traffic in slaves was a royal monopoly, and the Jews were often appointed as agents for the crown in their sale. Also, from Liebman, the Jews were the largest ship chandlers in the entire Caribbean region, where the shipping business was mainly a Jewish enterprise. The ships were not only owned by Jews, but were named by Jewish crews and sailed. Excuse me. They were manned by Jewish crews, and probably named after Jews, and sailed under the command of Jewish captains. The vital connection between sugar and slave was the underpinning of the rapidly growing fortunes of the New World. The famous triangle trade consisted of slaves brought from Africa, exchanged for sugars from the Caribbean islands, and taken to North American ports to be turned into rum to be used for buying African slaves from African slaveholders and dealers. And the Jews played a vital part in this lucrative trade. Brazil absorbed more slaves than any other location in the New World, while the North American continent only took in under 500,000 out of a delivery of 10 million or more slaves. Before I go on with this, again, please go listen to what I said about how many white slaves there were in the Americas and in North Africa from my last show. And also, David in Texas read, I don't know if you read the entire thing, but read from Who Brought the Slaves to America. And that's available freely online. And it's in Mike's archives, I think early on. So do check that out. And it really tells many of these same facts. The West, this is from Arnold Wiznitzer in Jews in Colonial Brazil, says the West India Company, which monopolized imports of slaves from Africa, sold slaves at public auctions against cash payments. It happens that cash was mostly in the hands of Jews. The buyers who appeared at the auctions were almost always Jews, and because of this lack of competitors, they could buy slaves at low prices. On the other hand, there was also no competition in the selling of the slaves to the plantation owners and other buyers. Profits up to 300% of the purchase value were often realized with high interest rates. If it happened that the date of such an auction fell on a Jewish holiday, the auction had to be postponed. And Judith Lycan Elkin writes, those who succeeded in establishing themselves under Dutch jurisdiction prospered as traders, middlemen, interpreters, and brokers of slaves. The Dutch West India Company monopolized the import of slaves, but the private entrepreneurs ran the slave auctions. Among these were numerous Jews, who also provided the credit that plantation masters needed until the sugar crop was brought in. Considering that the mill owners found it cheaper to replace a slave every 7 years than to feed him properly, business was brisk. Dr. Wiznitzer, quoted above, also maintained that Jews dominated the slave trade. The following statistics are telling. In Port Royal, Jamaica, in 1680, about 16% of Jewish households had no slaves. 16% of Jewish households had no slaves. In the non-Jewish community, this figure was over 47%. Wow. Likewise, 73.7% of Jewish households had between one and four slaves. In the non-Jewish community, the figure was 41.8%. That's from Scorched in 2000. Indeed, it seems from the following quote that the Jews had established themselves as the preeminent slave-holding class in Brazil early in the colonial era. From Leon, in the first half of the 17th century, notes Abram Leon, all the great sugar plantations in Brazil were in the hands of Jews, Caraco, Jamaica, and Suriname, Dutch Guinea. Booming, bustling Newport, Rhode Island, was one of their primary centers of the triangle trade. It was not only a center for the slave trade, but served also as a major producer of rum. According to one author who is not Jewish, Walter White, writing in 1968, claimed that all of the 22 distilleries in Newport were owned by Jews, who controlled the manufacture and sale of the infamous firewater in their trade with the Indians. They were prohibited in engaging in local commerce by Governor Stuyvesant and circumvented the restriction in this manner. Newport, after New York, held the highest concentration of Jews in North American cities of the 17th century. Smoke your Newport cigarettes, everybody. despite the fact that the New World trade was particularly advantageous for Jews who were freed from religious and civil restrictions imposed on them in Europe, and for whom the New World was indeed the promised land. As it was so, as it was for many aggressive, risk-taking entrepreneurs, they were still at that point in history no strangers to slaving or the trade in chattel. From Parks, in the period from the 5th to 8th century, Jews gradually took the place previously occupied by the Syrians as international traders, and they continued and perhaps developed the trade in slaves. Also from Parks, while the Jews were never the only traders, it is possible that the slave trade through northeastern Europe to the Slav countries and the land trades to the east were, for practical purposes, Jewish monopolies. The previous citations come from James Parks, a respected scholar who was considered Philo-Semitic rather than hostile to the Jews. No less a Jewish source than the Encyclopedia Judaica states that the first Jews that Poles encountered must certainly have been traders, probably slave traders, of the type called in the 12th century Jewish sources Holekki Rusya, or travelers to Russia. In the 10th century, notes Israel Abrahams, the Spanish Jews often owed their wealth to their trade in slaves. The many quotes are not meant to drown the reader in a sea of quotes, but rather to show him that throughout human history, Jews were not only slaveholders, but often slave traders, and even more dominated the trade. During the early Middle Ages, approximately 500 to 1000 AD, Jewish merchants dominated the trade between the Christian and Islamic worlds. Using trade routes established by the Roman Empire, they traveled the world of the time, covering territory from the Frankish Kingdom of the West through a network including North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, to India and China. The routes in the East almost track that of the Silk Road of later history and probably helped to lay the foundation for that famous road. The Jewish merchants were known as the Radhanites. The director of posts and police, who was the spymaster and post office general of his age, for the province of Jabal in the Abbasid Caliphate in the late 9th century, described them as being sophisticated and multilingual. The same description was given for the Jewish merchants of the early colonial era in the New World. You might call them the gifts of the diaspora. With Jews living in every land who would be fully conversant in the language of the nation in which they settled, and with many of their numbers traveling all the time, they acquired command of many of the languages of the lands through which they passed. And with fellow Jews in many ports and towns, they naturally knew about trade opportunities before their rivals. Also during this time in history, the kingdoms of Europe and North Africa banned one another's merchants from entering their ports, leaving the trade to Jews. Corsairs raided each other's ports, and the neutral Jews acted as go-betweens, a position that eventually evolved into that of middleman. And they put their money in there as the middleman for us now, so that they have full control over everything. The trade was in oils, incense, steel weapons, furs, and slaves. Under the Carolingian rulers, the Jewish traders were particularly favored. No doubt this may have been due to the fact that it was the Radhanites who established the first trade network that stretched from Western Europe to the Orient. Using letters of credit to transfer large quantities of money between their communities, they protected their caravans from theft. And this may have also been the precursor for the banking system of the Jews of the later Middle Ages and beyond. Slaves have been traded by nearly every civilization in history. There were slaves in the East, in the ancient Middle East, in every empire of antiquity, including that of the Greeks and Romans. Christians, Muslims, and Jews owned slaves. Given the universality of slavery, the depiction of it as somehow unique to the evil-minded Southerner of colonial America is preposterous. To quote Charcy McIntyre, Ph.D., in The Continuity of the International Slave Trade and Slave System from 1990, the Jewish slave trains moved across Europe from Germany to Verdun and finally to Muslim Spain with enslaved humans that originated in Bohemia, Moravia, and remoter Slavic lands. They carried slaves, furs, and swords to the Jewish Khazar kingdom on the Volga when they traveled eastward to China. The profit gained from this international trade laid the basis for Jewish wealth and money lending activities, the author tells us later. At that time in history, blacks from Africa, whites from the Balkans, Eastern Europe and the Caucasus, and Mongols were traded as slaves by Christian, Jewish, and Islamic traders. Certainly, there was no religious proscription of slavery among Jews. The following quote from the Talmud. I've actually already read this one, but it's about the 2,800 slaves that are promised to the Jews. Total figures for the slave population and the general population of the United States fill in another part of the story of slavery in the United States. Movie lore in the modern U.S. being what it is, many assume that everyone in the South was a slaveholder. In fact, only 4.8% of the population of the South were slaveholders at the time of the Civil War, and 1.4% of the U.S. population as a whole were slaveholders. 1.4% of the U.S. population as a whole were slaveholders. The white U.S. population at the time was 27 million, and of these, 385,000 were slave owners. The black population stood at 4.5 million blacks, approximately 13% of the total population. Of those, 261,988 were free blacks, of which 3,000 were slave owners themselves. The figures are from the 1860 census. So there were 3,000 black slave owners at that time. We're not often told about those blacks, are we? Mike did a great show on the black slave owners and how many of them interbred with the Jews to create a new type of semi-master class. The percentage of blacks of the total U.S. population was down since 1790 when the first U.S. census was taken. The total population at the time was 3,893,635, of whom 694,280 were slaves, or 18%. It is also interesting to note that only one individual in the country owned 1,000 slaves. Only a handful owned 500, according to the same census. Given these statistics, it does seem strange for those who support a program of unceasing reparations for slavery to be holding the entire population of the United States responsible for what only a minute fraction practiced, even at the time that slavery was extant. The statistics indicate that even the descendants of the slaveholders are an infinitesimally small percentage of the current population of the country. So the idea that there's any justification to sue the present-day population of the United States, of whom the vast majority are descendants of people who arrived after the Civil War, for the practice of slavery is illegal as well as guaranteed to worsen already deteriorating relations between the races. The concept of racial guilt is one heavily promoted by Jewish interests and as such bypasses an elemental aspect of Western law, that only an individual is responsible for his behavior, not his relatives and certainly not his descendants. But given that African Americans and Jews seem to accept this principle, it would seem that the NAACP might be interested in suing the ADL to collect for the disproportionate participation of Jews in the slave trade. But something tells me no. A little bit long, but that was Jews and slavery throughout history. Got about an hour left. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Blitzkrieg broadcast here. I should be getting a call from Dana Antiochus if he's still up. I told him that I was going to read some here in the first hour and then can get some of his thoughts on this subject in the second hour. So he hasn't slept yet. He works some strange hours. So hopefully I haven't put him to sleep with his reading and he'll call in shortly. One thing I wanted to bring up was how mechanization has not always eased the plight of the slave. For example, the cotton gin made it much, much easier for people to harvest cotton. However, this caused the cotton trade to boom, and many more blacks were brought in to work on the plantations. So it also seems that in our world today, the more we can do, the more efficient we become, the better we are at multitasking, the more we have to do, but for less money. So somehow this efficiency just means that we're more efficient slaves, not better rewarded or anything like that. Here are some stats about the cotton gin invented by Eli Hugh Whitney and its relationship to slavery. Well, it took a single slave about 10 hours to separate a single pound of fiber from the seeds. A team of two or three slaves using a cotton gin could produce around 50 pounds of cotton in just one day. The number of slaves rose in concert with the increase in cotton production, increasing from around 700,000 in 1790 to around 3.2 million in 1850. By 1860, the southern states were providing two-thirds of the world's supply of cotton and up to 80% of the crucial British market. The cotton gin thus transformed cotton as a crop and the American South into the globe's first agricultural powerhouse, and according to many historians, was the start of the Industrial Revolution. So we've been somewhat enslaved to these machines, as I said, with just having increased efficiency, which is just a code word for us having to do more work, multitask our brains, and get less money. That being said, sometimes the presence of slaves, I think, holds back some inventions. For example, Heron of Alexandria was a very impressive inventor, created marvelous things. I suggest you look into him. Basically created the fundamentals for computer programming, which was reflected in his system for making an automated theater that would run about 20 minutes of play, different scene changes and everything, all completely automated using potential energy turned into kinetic energy. It was a very, very elaborate system. And he did a lot of things around Alexandria, one of which was inventing the steam engine. This is in the BC era, before our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. He invented the steam engine. It would spin around and not do much else. So it was never really developed for a practical purpose, but it could have been. Why would you need a steam engine when you've got lots of slaves? He wasn't BC. I guess he was born in 10 AD. So he lived after the death of our Lord and Savior. So he invented the steam engine. People wouldn't come upon it for almost 2,000 years again and utilize its power. But then, again, of course, people had to be enslaved to this machine to keep it running. Okay? And I could foresee a future in which they just get rid of many of the flesh slaves. Once they've honed their robots to a certain point, they get rid of most people. They just keep the ones who can repair the robots and program them to do different things. But they would be a much better slave, and they wouldn't be as loathsome to the Jews as our goyim, all right? They just consider us so filthy and dirty. So perhaps one day the human slaves will be mainly replaced by the robot slaves. You actually look at their media, and they're trying to move towards this direction. There's even the movie Astro Boy, in which there's a big robot that has Zog, Z-O-G, as in Zionist Occupational Government, spray-painted on his chest. He's also got some rainbows that were drawn on him, all sorts of other things. Fascinating. Fascinating, this Zog system. I think that their bringing of slaves to the United States, well, it wasn't only to make better profits. Sure, that's a big part of it, always a part of it. But they wanted to introduce this racial stock into what was a burgeoning white country. They knew the long-term repercussions. Even if they knew that slavery was one day going to be abolished, they wanted Africans in America. And we're often not told about the real thoughts of people who were seen as against slavery. There's Jefferson, who himself had slaves, seemed to have inclinations towards wanting to free them, but I'm guessing he treated them pretty damn well, better than many workers are treated today. Apparently, he also made love to one or two and had some children by them. He was a race traitor, right? But he's often quoted a little bit misleadingly. So I'm going to kind of set the record straight here with our founding fathers and Father Abraham as well concerning their thoughts on this subject. This is actually just a note from Might is Right, one of the footnotes where they actually detail this. When Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, he included these well-known words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Nothing is, nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free. These words are proudly chiseled into the granite of the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., and are considered the cornerstone of the civil rights movement in America. But the words, as they have been taught to most Americans, constitute a lie. What Jefferson really said was this: nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free. Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion has drawn indelible lines of distinction between them. It is still in our power to direct the process of emancipation and deportation peaceably, and in such slow degrees that the evil will wear off insensibly, and their place be, filled up by free white laborers. If, on the contrary, it is left to force itself on, human nature must shudder at the prospect held up." So Jefferson saw that the enslavement of blacks was not good. He wanted them to be free. He said that was their destiny to be free. But it was also the destiny for us to separate. And if we didn't, it would not be a very good prospect. He would shudder at that prospect. And he noted that the black slaves, their function would be replaced by the white laborers, free white laborers. But that wouldn't make as much profit for the masters, would it? They don't like to pay out to pay out to us. Now, the goyim need to be treated harshly. We need to be brought a peg down, peg or two. Think about how much wages have decreased while living conditions, cost of living has increased. Continuing on here. "That most of our founding fathers were in complete agreement with Jefferson's words is seen from the fact that many owned slaves. It is worth noting here that the other supposed great champion of racial equality, Abraham Lincoln, shared the views of our founding fathers. He wrote, 'Negro equality? Fudge! How long in the government of a God, great enough to make and maintain this universe, shall there continue knaves to vend and fools to gulp so low a piece of demagogism as this?' From the collected works of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln also wrote, "A separation of the races is the only perfect preventative of amalgamation.
But as immediate separation is impossible, the next best thing is to keep them apart where they are not already together. Such separation, if ever effected at all, must be effected by colonization. The enterprise is a difficult one, but where there is a will, there is a way. Akon, get this Back to Africa movement going. Where there is a will, there is a way. We will make it happen. Moving on. In 1858, he made the following remarks in a speech. I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will ever forbid the two races from living together on terms of social and political equality. That was from the fourth debate with Stephen A. Douglas at Charleston. Lincoln spoke the following words in Washington, D.C. on September 22, 1862. I have urged the colonization of the Negroes, and I shall continue. My Emancipation Proclamation was linked with this plan. There is no room for two distinct races of white men in America, much less for two distinct races of white and blacks. I can conceive of no greater calamity than the assimilation of the Negro into our social and political life as our equal. We can never attain the ideal union our fathers dreamed, with millions of an alien inferior race among us, whose assimilation is neither possible nor desirable. Wow, so Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was linked directly to a Back to Africa plan. Could that be why he was shot after he served his purpose? Seems like it could be one of the reasons, if he still intended to hold to that. So let's go to the present day. There is a straight-haired Negro in Washington named Charlie Rangel. He had a big tax scandal, even though he was head of the Ways and Means Commission. Still there in Congress. He owed over $500,000 in back taxes. How is a congressman making that much money? These guys are so corrupt. It is disgusting. And this is an article by Hunter Walker, fairly short. He is saying some outrageous things. Titled, Charlie Rangel, Tea Party is same group of white crackers who fought civil rights. So he's saying that the Tea Party is the same group of the white crackers who fought civil rights. In an interview with the Daily Beast published Friday, Representative Charlie Rangel, a Democrat from New York, suggested Tea Partiers are the same group who fought for segregation during civil rights movement. It is the same group we faced in the South with those white crackers and the dogs and the police. They didn't care about how they looked, Rangel said. Because of this, Rangel said the Tea Party could be defeated using the same tactics employed against Jim Crow. It was just fierce indifference to human life that caused America to say, enough is enough. I don't want to see it, and I am not a part of it. What the hell? If you have to bomb little kids and send dogs out against human beings, give me a break, said Rangel. Okay, a guy from Congress who supports all of these foreign wars. He's saying, if you have to bomb little kids and send dogs out against human beings, give me a break. What are these wars all about? What is Israel all about? Bombing kids and sending out your dogs against human beings. This is what American policy is all about. This is what the modern Judaized police force, police state in the United States is all about, with their SWAT teams all over, bombing kids, sending out dogs against human beings. It's sickening, but he's saying that the Tea Partiers, who obviously we know are a controlled group, are the white crackers from the South who fought for segregation. And that because there was a bombing, that if you have to bomb little kids and send dogs out against human beings, give me a break. What about all the violence incited against the white man by the Negro, Martin Luther King Jr.? Now I've got to drive around and every single other street is Martin Luther King Jr. King, MLK Boulevard. It's everywhere. This man is honored as higher than a god, as a prophet of God, the main prophet of God. I have a dream. Sickening, sickening world we live in. I've got a call here, though, so I will take it. Caller, you're on the air. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Kyle, this is General Antiochus.
How you doing, my tired general?
I'm
tired
holding
but not
up,
retired.
Man. Yeah. Holding up, man. Great show. Great show as usual. And it's firing me up, man. I was trying to sleep, trying to doze off, but that Kyle lightning storm just pulverized me, kept me awake. And now I'm angry.
Good. Good. That's the way we need to be about this. We can't be turning the other cheek, working as hard as we can for Master because he's a representative of the Lord, right? Yeah, they're lording over us. It's sick.
Yes, sir.
It's sick of people angry.
I have a Martin Luther King Boulevard not too far, within walking distance, actually, from my house.
They're everywhere.
And, oh, yeah. You think of this man. There was a pamphlet somebody put out years ago, I think, called The Beast as Saint. And it detailed his many relations with white women. I believe he was actually having sex with white prostitutes even on the very day he was murdered. This is from what I hear.
David actually read that entire pamphlet on his show. I think it was before you got on the network, so it's back there in the archives, so people can check that out. Yeah, some really revealing material about the man that we all consider so saintly.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, even people like Malcolm X, Dr. Malcolm X, he was a lot better than King on one level, but a lot of people don't realize Mr. Malcolm X, as much as he loved hating on white people, you know, he had an Armenian girlfriend and other white women as well. You know, so this is something we see a lot. They love to hate us, but they also love to enjoy our women.
Yeah. We hate the white man, love the white woman. Now, Dana, I wanted to get your opinion on this matter of slavery because I think it is one of these key, crucial issues that if we're able to show the documentation for how many white slaves there were, not just in America, but around the world throughout history. Now, this is not a uniquely African experience. I think this breaks down so many of their barriers. And I also think that showing the Jewish control of not only slavery, but also these black liberation movements and the NAACP is going to start to wake people up once they are shown the facts of what's really going on, and especially with the white slavery thing. White people should be furious that they were never told anything about this and were only given sob stories about how all of their ancestors were just so cruel and harsh to blacks, whipping them left and right.
Yeah, I mean, it just flips reality on its head. It's another one of these lightning rods, just like the Holocaust or the Holo-Hoax. Slavery is it's huge, or just the entire narrative of World War II and presentation of the good war, the good guys versus the evil, demonic bad guys. It's another one of these massive reality taking the blue pill or the red pill, whatever it was, from the Matrix, you know. And, you know, you would think that this kind of information would really shock people, but And I think it does. It's just a matter of getting it out there. And it is getting out there by, you know, wonderful shows like yours and our network. Unfortunately, so that, the masses are just, they don't have access to this material unless they look for it, you know?
But Dana, it's an interesting thing you said there about the Matrix, of course, because Morpheus, the black man, tells Neo that he's a slave. Very symbolic that a white man has to get told by a black man about the fact that he's actually a slave. So it ties into that kind of aspect of these shows. But where do they go afterwards? Where are the free people? They're in Zion.
Zion, yeah. And my friend, when I was educating, one of my best friends throughout the high school years, you know, I would present these little points, these subliminal points to him, and he caught on so quickly, man. He would look at me. I remember when we were we had a group of friends and we were watching that movie, and then they reveal the name Zion, you know, and he just gave me that look with that smirky smile, saying, "Geez, you're right, Dana. Everything you are telling me is the truth." And, you know, it's just, it's amazing, man. I mean, it's the way these guys have gotten away literally with murder, genocide, and slavery, and they've blamed it in a massive collective act of projection, classic projection. They blamed it on their enemies, on white people. You know, of course, I mean, that's not to say, look, we're innocent, the white race has never done anything wrong. I'm not saying that, but the problem is when you put these facts in accordance to balance out, you know, what should be an objective view of history, it changes the whole story, doesn't it? And somehow these amazing monumental facts just seem to slip by in the education system and in our Hollywood movies. You know, and I mean, when the Jews come out and they tell us openly in their own newspapers, I mean, I've got just recently I posted on my Facebook page, I uncovered a little gem here. This is from The Forward. And the article is entitled, "Jews Mostly Supported Slavery or Kept Silent During Civil War. Civil War Transformed Community in North and South." And this is by Ken Yellis, published July 1st, 2013, issue of July 5th, 2013. Y'all can look this up. I would read it for you if you wanted. It's pretty short. But, I mean, basically, it just reiterates everything that you've been going over in your program here, and I must say it's just been an amazing one. I haven't listened to the first piece of it, but you know, this is a subject matter that it's dark. It's really dark when you think of the exploitation of our people, and it's really like a double whammy, because not only do people not know about this at all, but the fact that this is all real and this happened and the suffering and trauma of our race, you know, it just boggles the mind how they can get away with suppressing the truth. But we know that the truth in the end will win out.
I think so. David in the chat is wondering why a Yankee like you is saying a word like y'all. he didn't put in those words, but he was wondering if you said y'all.
Yeah,
there.
Well, I mean, as a Northerner, I really have come to respect the Southern antebellum tradition. There's a part of me that really, I always knew there was something about the rebel flag and just the Confederacy and just, you know, the entire history. There was something I identified with there, because I always said to myself, geez, yes, the North was racialist. It was racially aware, just as the South was. A lot of people don't realize this, but during the Civil War, you had something called the Irish draft riots. I don't know. Have you ever heard of this, Kyle?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, basically a group of white Northern Irishmen, they said, geez, you know, should we really be going down south to murder our white brothers and, you know, racial kinsmen for blacks. I mean, that was something that bothered them at that time, and it led to a riot. And this is something that is just not taught, again, in history. The band Nordic Thunder actually did a great song about this very topic. And, you know, it just shows that history is more complicated, to say the least. You know, even when you dig through all the propaganda and the lies and distortions, when you look objectively, you know, the Civil War, it's just another massive tragedy. Just like World War II, World War I, all these internecine fratricidal wars, I couldn't have been on either side of that war. On the one hand, you had the expansion of the black race across America in the name of slavery. And that was a racist cause. That was part of the cause of the North. People don't realize it wasn't just abolitionism. Part of the reason people were abolitionists was because they didn't want black slavery spreading across the country. And some people have demographers at that time, and you know, retroactively looking back, some have commented that if the South did in fact win, you know, the black population in the United States might have actually been a lot higher than what we ended up with. So you know, I mean, that is one way to look at it there. But on the other hand, the South at least had its system of segregation, and, you know, just their general attitude of separation of the races and maintaining white rule. Whereas the North eventually succumbed to Jewish, you know, malfeasance or whatever you want to call it, and the North, the liberal puritanical values that we find up here, kind of won over. And then eventually the South was forced by at the point of a gun and a bayonet to integrate their schools. So, you know, I mean, it's just been one massive you know, surrendering of power that the white man has been forced to do over time. And now we are stuck in this situation that we find ourselves.
Yeah, and if we aren't already in complete white slavery, that's what they're instituting, as far as I see it right now. I mean, right now it's a very much bondage. We're forced to do many things and basically slave away for this system that is only basically working against us. They are funding our own demise. It's such a sick and twisted system. So I think we've got to obviously stop supporting it, but also actively work to end this system of slavery.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think that your tax dollars are going into a system that wants to exterminate you, it's one of the most depressing thoughts you can really think. I mean, when you realize, when you look around you, you know, if you're not living in an all-white area, which I'm not, and when you start to see the reproductive rates of non-whites, and you realize, geez, I'm funding this, you know, and at the same time, I'm working a job, maybe two jobs, just to try to feed a family or survive, and, you know, because of responsibilities and trying to be a conscious citizen, you know, whites tend to not have children. So we're funding our own genocide, essentially. It's sick.
It's reparations, right? Because all these other minorities, they've been so oppressed by the white man, as the story goes. So now we've got to fund them having very large families, even if they're from Asia, from Africa itself, from India. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, white man. You're the devil. You need to put a monkey on your back, a couple, and you've got to carry them along and be a complete slave to the Jew, to the minorities who are the vast global majorities. And work for everyone else's benefit but your own. Try to organize anything, like a student union, like some kind of organization that is promoting your own interests, and you will have the full fury of this system this complete anti-white system coming down upon you.
Oh, geez. Go ahead. Finish your point. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, if they don't kill you outright, they can just use their pen to put you in the pen, the penitentiary, and then you will be a more penitent man, won't you?
Yes, sir. You know, that's this is something that we really have to wake up to and realize is just the nature of the beast that we are facing. Because, you know, the white student union and things of this nature are just like testing the waters. That we're finally starting. I mean, geez, I don't know why it took so long for us to finally start to push back a little bit. But what the important point we have to take out of this is just the hostility. I mean, when you stare into the eyes of these hundreds of leftists, anarchists, Antifa, anti-racist action, One People's Party, all these different Jewish proxy groups that are put out there to basically be foot soldiers for the left side of capital, in my opinion. You know, you realize, and a lot of these people are white, mind you, you know, completely brainwashed to the point that they are they have become stormtroopers for Judaism. And if you try and organize anything, you're going to be looking down the eyes of these truly hateful people that want to just rip you apart. And without the cops there to get in the middle of them, geez, it would be a bloodbath. And I've seen it multiple times, you know, and this is what people have to realize is that 50 years of intense Jewish programming and propaganda did its magic. It really worked exactly the way that they wanted to. They studied psychology. These people are not stupid. You cannot underestimate them. They know, you know, going back to Bernays and Freud and all these people, one thing that they studied was our psychology, and they learned how to manipulate our empathy and our compassion, much of it coming from Christianity. So they've been twisting the sword into our spine in many different angles, and the pain has only begun.
Now, I think this has been going on for thousands of years, of course, but over 100 years ago, Ragnar Redbeard noticed exactly what was going on here and commented upon it in Might is Right. And I've got a passage or a few paragraphs here that is rather revelatory. If you want to stay on the air, you can sure. Let me know what you think about it afterwards. All right?
Yeah.
Moses Maimonides, the philosopher of Hebraism, boldly suggested this view to Orthodox Talmudists. The teachings of the Christian church, he proclaimed, tend to bring to perfection all mankind, so that they serve Jehovah with one consent. For, since the whole world is thus full of the words of the Messiah, of the teachings of the Holy Writ, and the commandments, these words have spread to the ends of the earth, even if any man deny the binding character of them now. Which, being interpreted, meaneth, tolerate, O children of Israel, the false religion of the crucified prophet. It will serve your ends most admirably. When the tribes of the West serve Jehovah with one consent, behold, they shall also serve you. Christ shall bring them to perfection, and ye shall put them in bonds. They have made you weep and suffer. Ye shall make them drip tears of blood, for the Lord your God hath said it. 19 centuries of evangelization with a Hebrew Bible as basis has resulted in what? The political, social, financial, and philosophical domination of the Hebrew. We study his falsified chronicles, his melancholy literature, and his prophetic outpourings, as if alone in such a nauseous heap of rubbish and stench, the summum bonum, supreme good, was to be found. Not an acre changeth hands, not a battleship lifts an anchor, not a plowshare cleaves the soil, not a president vetoes a bill, not a diplomat signs a protocol, not an emperor waves a saber without direct inspiration from the hidden Hebrew potentate. Behold, the king is in his counting house, counting out his money, and such a king Israel is absolute dictator because he is absolute proprietor. The gold and the silver and the credits of the world belong to him. And as long as he hires politicians to utilize the military arm of government in the collection of his loans in defense of his ironclad safety vaults, he is an irresponsible Jehovah Jireh vagrant. But should force ever fail him, the lean dogs outside the wall will leap snarling upon him and spoil him of his spoil, that the fittest may survive. The Jews are ministers of gold, great bankers who see in the people and the state a mine to be worked. Our lifeblood is drawn from us by these harpies of finance and the gaming table, who mock us with illusions while they strip us of our all. The harm which the Jews commit does not come from individuals, but from the very constitution of these people. They are the locusts, caterpillars, which ravage France, to whom commerce ought to be prohibited. There are two distinct yet parallel species of the parasitical Semite. The first, represented by the communists, Karl Marx, Ferdinand LaSalle, Stepniak, and Jesus the Dreamer. The second, by Alexander Goshen, Baron Lionel Nathan Rothschild, Evelyn Baring, and Judas Iscariot the banker. Between them, they've practically extinguished civil liberty and personal independence wherever they have been sheltered. Viper-like, do they not bite the very mother that gives them suck? What have they ever done to Gaul, France, but eat her heart out? And Gaul was first to emancipate them. What are they now doing to Germany, Russia, England, America, Africa, Australia? Poisoning the brain cells of the enslaved multitude while taking in pledge the plow and the harrow, the millstones and the mill. Over nations and empires and colonies and vassalage hangs the idle sign of the brazen crucifix that cures no ill. Over a world in bondage looms the dread shadow of the three golden balls, which references the symbol of the pawnbroker, which was a trade that was once almost exclusively dominated by Jews throughout Europe and England. So the pawnbroker, I guess, was represented by those three golden balls. Hope you got that. And he's talking about how Israel's controlling everything. And this is in a time well before the actual state of Israel was created. And it still is all ringing completely true. Dana, you there?
Absolutely. Yes, I am here. And what a powerful quote indeed that was. It really says it all right there. And I think this is what people have to understand. You know, we get a lot of flack from other networks and other personalities in this movement. You know, you can't talk about Christianity. But guys, really, this is their most powerful weapon. If you can't see this, the Jews had to use, they had to institute and interject something to tame us. It's all about taming the beast. They had to domesticate us into the sheep that we are today. And, you know, this has worked like a charm for them. You know, without Christianity, yes, of course, it had its, they did have to face their persecutions here and there, but they overcame them. You know, eventually they had to know that by giving the Gentile, and more specifically the European, this religion, they were going to be on the fast track to domination and supremacy, because you can't be worshiping a Jewish God and live a humble lifestyle of humility and self-denial and, you know, just complete altruism towards the rest of humanity, while this other group that gave you the religion in the first place has a whole philosophy opposite of that, which basically is about obtaining power at all costs. You know, so this is why we're stuck in this problem right now. We have to free the minds of our people, which means freeing the souls of our race, and we need to light the fire that is dormant right now. And once that fire springs forth, it will be unstoppable. And this is why National Socialism was so successful as a philosophy, because it was essentially the rebirth of European pagan tradition. Just like the Renaissance, it was a modern day Renaissance, and that's how I look at it. It was the light coming out of the darkness of the church and the medieval period and this type of thing. So we need to find that light. We need the sun because Aryans, after all, are children of the sun.
Dana, interesting point being brought up here by Wendy in the chat. She's asking. When the Christians weren't allowed to lend money because it was banned by the Catholic Church, is that when the Jews were the pawnbrokers? And that whole thing, the Jews ran the church, and what they were doing when they make it so that their people can't loan money, can't take the issue, the banking into their own hands, it just gives the Jews a complete monopoly over the trade, and that's how they get our power.
Absolutely. That is why these blindsided Christians, they just can't see that. They look at it from the other perspective. They look at it as usury is an evil, and the Christian church rightfully banned it for its own people for their spiritual salvation, in the same way that Islam is against usury as well. But instead of taking a step back and analyzing it further and say, well, wait a minute, though, what does that in effect do? It gives all the power of usury to the Jews, to your enemies, to the middlemen. And it creates a complete monopoly for them. So absolutely, man.
And the church collects all of this money. But how much do they actually give out to people who need it? No, they just buy up all sorts of important artwork and books, and they burn many different libraries of knowledge and hoard it all for themselves, keep all of the money for themselves, and then proclaim to be all high and mighty because, oh, yeah, we banned usury. It's just – it's all a front. These people want to seem – so high and righteous when they're just committing organized crime. Now, Dana, we have a call on the line. We could maybe go to this and see what they have to say here. Hello, you're on the air. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Caller, you there? Going once, going twice, gone. Okay.
Maybe they were just calling in to listen sometimes.
Yeah, I put them on mute. They can still listen.
Okay. But, yeah, that is the bottom line. People shouldn't misunderstand what we're saying here in regards to usury, because it's not that we're pro-usury. The problem is that, you know, either you do not – you can't have a state where – your own people are denied, this power to essentially make money from money at compound interest and exponentially, whilst, your enemies have this power, you are denied it. So now you have a situation of economic slavery and debt. And this is what we're facing. This is another thing that ties into the whole concept and theme of the show, is just the economic slavery of being under the rule of the Federal Reserve System since 1913. And this, of course, is the same year that the Anti-Defamation League was created. It's the same year as, what else happened? The income tax, you know? So, mm-hmm. I mean, this is just a monumental time. And that's why when people are looking for a rough date on when did we lose our country, you know, that is the date, 1913.
100 years ago. I think we lost it in progressive steps for sure, but that was one of those really crucial years.
I guess you could really argue the Civil War, probably was the beginning of the end. But
maybe the adoption of the Constitution even.
Sure. Right. I mean, that's we can really go anywhere we want with that. And that was one major point that I was trying to make when we talk about America and this romanticizing of this country. You know, I'm really at the point where I'm trying to focus on looking at this as an exploitative nation from the very onset. And despite the epics like the Great Westward Expansion and the Frontiersmen and the Mountain Men and this kind of thing, I mean, I sympathize with that kind of viewpoint. But on the other hand, it just seems like this monstrosity of a country, which is really not a country, but just a corporate state run by Jews. This has really been just it's been the nail in the coffin for our race. So we have to overcome this cancer,
I feel like the American enterprise was mainly about getting other people, non-Jews, to pioneer, to go out to the frontiers to establish the different trading routes and the roads and build all the infrastructure, thinking it was theirs, only so that the Jew could finally exploit everybody even that much better, conquer a whole new continent. And you've really got to see how they were involved at almost every single level of this operation from the beginning of what we're told is the American conquest, you know, obviously not acknowledging any of the other visits made by Europeans and others to the North American continent. We're just going to pretend that didn't happen, and Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, right?
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, what happened was you had the Aryans, the Anglo-Saxons, and, you know, these people would go out and they would fight, they would battle the nature, tame the forest, they would engage in racial war with the Indians, they would clear the path, and then once it was safe, then you had the middlemen and the merchants come in to profit off of, what was cleared, the pathfinders who had previously cleared the land, you know, and you had guys like Levi Strauss out there selling jeans to the frontiersmen, you know. So and this whole idea of just slavery and how when I was researching it and when I found out that only 1% of the white South American population, only about 1% owned a majority of the slaves, maybe 90% of the slaves, and of that 1%, a huge number or proportion or percentage disproportionate were Jews. And then, going even further back, you have just this whole concept of introducing a foreign black slave race into the continent itself. And I wonder, Kyle, do you think this was intentional? This was a conscious act of biological warfare against the future of the United States. Did they know what they were doing when they were bringing these people here?
Most certainly. I think they've used this strategy to take down many, many empires in the past. You know, the Romans, let's say. You could go back to the Egyptians, the Babylonians. Sure. It seems that they were all kind of mixed out of power. They brought in the slaves. They said, oh, this is good for you. Hey, you'll be able to get cheap labor. You conquered them. You defeated them. Don't kill them. You can use them. You know, don't drive them out. Just use them, right? And it, you know, for a time it seems good. Oh, look how bountiful and plenty everything is. And then along come the Jewish liberators, perhaps. Along come those who say, oh no, they're your equals, or they are very attractive. You should mix them. Or even it's just within our people, a certain percentage of them, when there is a foreign alien stock among them, we'll go after it. We'll find that to be exotic and therefore erotic. And I think that just having this alien population mixed in with us is what was going to destroy us. And Abraham Lincoln acknowledged that. Thomas Jefferson acknowledged that, as I read earlier. Sure. But yet the two are always used to justify having, you know, free, equal, and nowadays it's more than equal because of affirmative action and other programs, blacks who are now becoming the ultimate racists against whites.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, starting from the founding fathers, you know, you have this Alexander Hamiltonian philosophy versus the Jeffersonian. And, this is the roots of the central banking system with Hamilton. You know, and there were periods when they tried to rein this thing in, like Andrew Jackson and then William Jennings Bryant. You know, but I mean, eventually this moneyed power, we never really separated ourselves from Rothschild-controlled England. You know, and it's just been downhill. I mean, aside from the period of the 1920s, which was like an America First period, and then again in the 1950s, you know, this is when they tried to put restrictions on immigration. They call it the nativist period. You know, we had some minor setbacks to this overall Jewish plan with a racially healthy kind of philosophy. But again, they nailed us between World War One and World War Two. That was their coup de grace and coup d'etat. And ever since then, that final drastic, catastrophic, suicidal Peloponnesian War of Western civilization that we have not recovered from, ever since that point, it's been just, you know, Jewish supremacy here on in, you know, and they have been closing the gaps and, you know, just making sure that all their bases are covered. And, you know, the consolidation of this Jewish matrix of power, or the control grid, as Mike Sledge says, you know, this is really nightmarish. It is nightmarish. And when you think that the National Socialists came this close to putting a final stake in this vampire, and thanks to the Jewish-run United States and the B'nai Brits, as you call them, or, you know, I mean, here we are. But, you know, we will not give up because it is not in our nature to do so. And we know that as bad as it is, hey, we have everything to fight for. This cause is the only cause really worth dying for and living for. And it is why we exist, and we will not allow ourselves to be defeated.
Yes, I think that's the way that we have to really ensure the freedom of our children and their children's children. We can't just sell them into slavery like many of our ancestors did for short-term material gains in their brief lifetime. They weren't thinking long-term enough or just didn't care. And if we have more people who are racially aware, then we will be able to look out for each other to ensure our survival. And I think that we are reaching a very critical point here where this is going to be a supreme concern for many, many people in this world, especially because they've been ramping up their anti-white hatred, getting people so revved up that it's going to cause a backlash and a reaction that I don't think they're going to be able to properly control. They're going to try, but you know what? We're going to do. They're going to try, and we're going to do, and we will be victorious. If I have anything to say about it, and I'm saying something right now. Dana, any final thoughts before we close out this show here?
Yes, I think you had a great show, and this is one of the things that we really should focus on when we talk about universal or pan-nationalism or camaraderie with other race nationalists that understand the Jewish problem. This whole slavery issue, when it comes to light, could be a very valuable tool in mobilizing the blacks, who are already kind of onto the scent, I would say, and eliminating a proxy that is aligned against us fighting on behalf of Jewry and possibly turning it around on them and making them our proxy against them. You know, this is just something to think about. And I have a quick quote here, which I think goes very well to end the program out. It's by a French reformer in the 19th century. His name was E. Canet, C-A-N-N-O-T, in La Renovation, Journal of the Socialist School of Charles Fourier, F-O-U-R-I-E-R. He writes, "Jews, to the heights of your Sinai, I humbly lift myself. I stand erect and cry out to you, in behalf of all my humble equals, of all those whom your spoliation has brought to grief, who died in misery through you and whose trembling shades accuse you. Jews, for Cain and Iscariot. Leave us. Ah, cross the Red Sea again and go down there to the desert, to the promised land, which is waiting for you, the only country fit for you. Oh, you wicked, rude, and dishonest people. Go there to Israel.
All right. Very good. Dana, thanks so much for joining me for this second hour here. Really appreciate you taking the time to give your thoughts on this important issue. And people can catch your show, of course, every Wednesday night. Very good program. Everybody tune into that. And, of course, I am on Mondays. But check out everybody here at RenegadeBroadcasting.com because we've got a lot of information coming at you. And hopefully RenegadeBroadcasting.com will stay up, even though it's been having some problems, it seems. It will continue to be your source for honest and hard-hitting radio. Dana, again, thank you so much, and thanks so much to those out there listening. I'm going to go out with always a pleasure, Dana. I'm going to go out with the audio from a video I did, The Reality of Racial Violence.
How black is that? And in the movie, I have to wear chains. How whack is it? But don't be worried about it, because I get out the chains, I get free, I save my wife, and I kill all the white people in the movie. How great is that?
I don't want to go to the future and find out what happens to white people, because we're going to pay hard for this shit. You got to know that.
These eight adults and four teenagers, the youngest just 12, were arrested after Seminole County Sheriff's deputies say they beat up pregnant Ashley Flurney.
Well, it's all there, black and white, really. I just hope the white part doesn't screw it up, okay? Because we tend to do that.
Yes.
What do you mean we're lucky to be white?
It's not luck. It's privilege.
We're privileged that people see us, not the color.
Privilege that we don't get stared at when we walk into the room.
Privilege that we don't get followed by security when we go shopping.
Or pulled over when we're in the wrong neighborhood.
We're privileged because society is set up for us. And our silence keeps it in place.
We're privileged, and that's unfair.
Two teenagers connected to one serious crime. The rape and robbery of a pizza delivery driver.
We're not going to just fall from number one to two. They're going to hold us down and fuck us in the ass forever. And we totally deserve it. We totally deserve it.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression. Sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression. And it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy.
Some cracker out there on the right.
To me, whiteness is an identity that rises entirely out of oppression. Whiteness is not a culture, it's not a religion, it's not a language, it's simply an oppressive social category.
Ground weather, it's the weatherman or the weather underground, the last above ground convention. And sitting in a room, and the question that was debated was it or was it not the duty of every good revolutionary to kill all newborn white babies? And at that point, it seemed like a relevant framing of an issue. The logic being, hey, look, through no fault of their own, these white kids are going to grow up to be part of an oppressive racial establishment internationally. And so really, your duty is to kill newborn white babies.
We are going to exterminate white people, because that, in my estimation, is the only conclusion I have come to. We have to exterminate white people off of the face of the planet.
Census Bureau just reported that for the first time in U.S. history, minorities now seem to be surpassing white folks in births. And the forecast is that white folks are on track to becoming, and I hate to say this, the minority in America.
But don't be worried about it, because I get out the chains, I get free, I save my wife, and I kill all the white people in the movie.
I prayed in there.
Get out of town by Sunday. I say if they don't get out of town, we kill the men, we kill the women, we kill the children, we kill the babies, we kill the blind, we kill the crippled, we kill the crazy, we kill the maggots, we kill the lesbians. I said, God damn it, we kill them all.
Going to exterminate white people, because that, in my estimation, is the only conclusion I have come to. We have to
kill them all! Kill them all! Why kill them all? Why kill the women? First, why kill the babies?
I save my wife and I kill all the white people in the movie.